We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for our show, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about prostate cancer. One of the things that we have to say right at the beginning is that prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in men. But right away, we also want to say that we have made significant progress in early detection of prostate cancer and also in treating the disease. About one man in six will be diagnosed with prostate cancer, but only one in 35 will die from it. And in fact, today, more than 2 million men in the United States who were treated at some point for prostate cancer are still alive. Our guest for this hour is Dr. Arthur Burnett. He is one of the country's leading experts in the area of prostate cancer. He's professor in the Department of Urology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where he is also director of the Basic Science Lab in Neurourology. He also holds professional appointments at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, including director of the Male Consultation Clinic. He is also clinician scientist at the James Buchanan Brady Urological Institute. And he is interested in a number of things that have to do with men's urinary tract health. He's also recognized as a world authority in the science and medicine of male erectile dysfunction. And he is the co-author of a book that I think would be very helpful for anyone who has just been diagnosed with prostate cancer or maybe knows someone who is, or perhaps just wants to know about more about the experiences that men have had. The title of the book is Prostate Cancer Survivors Speak Their Minds, and it is stories from men talking about their experiences with the disease, and then some comment from Dr. Burnett. It's a paperback book. It is published by Wiley, and you might want to take a look at it. Questions, of course, are welcome. Now, whenever we have doctors on the program, we always try to encourage people to remember, at least remind them, that we can't do diagnosis over the phone. But we do programs like this to try to answer questions and to add to your health knowledge. So I don't want to prevent anyone, discourage anybody from calling, as long as you understand that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And email. You can send your email to us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And Dr. Burnett, hello.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
Well, I think that the book can be very valuable. And as I said, as I read the book and read the stories of these men, I think that, again, for anybody, if you've just been diagnosed, if you have any concern, maybe you have a family history, maybe you have a brother or a dad, or somebody who's close to you who has been through it, I think this really helps. And clearly it gets at the questions that all men have when they first get the word that they have cancer and when they start trying to think about what to do about it and what that's going to mean to them. So I think it's a really good resource.
Well, I appreciate your comment on that. And indeed, these are carefully selected stories where we hope that messages are out there for almost any man who is encountering this, or a family member, disease state, where there's a message from these different stories that address whatever each man may be encountering.
How this year, just to take a time period and a number, how many new cancers do we expect to detect?
Well, in general, we expect in the ballpark of 200,000 new diagnoses of prostate cancer. Yearly. Hmm.
And now here, I'm sure, of course, the answer to this question depends on the individual. It's always different from one guy to the next. But say, if you catch the cancer early, and if it's limited to the prostate, that it has not spread outside of the prostate, what's the prognosis like?
Well, things are very, very favorable if it's an early diagnosis. So that's key. That's why we do stress getting in, getting your doctor evaluations. This is a silent killer. It's a disease state that can develop and progress without symptoms. So that's the important message. But again, diagnosed early, a good outcome.
Yeah. There are certainly a number of risk factors. Age is one, because it's pretty rare before 50, and family history is another. But say, setting those things aside, is there anything that you could point to that would be an identifiable risk factor?
Well, you touched on those things. Certainly, we think that certain ethnic populations are disproportionately affected. So those of African American descent, we certainly recognize as having a higher incidence of prostate cancer.
Mm. There, that's one of these questions that I'm sure it interests physicians a lot, and also is probably kind of frustrating. Because, as I understand it, in fact, African-American men are the most at-risk men in the world for prostate cancer, and that we really don't know why.
Well, that's true. And the risk is there with regard to diagnoses made as well as deaths from prostate cancer. The association may be something genetic being the cause, but it may also be at least in the United States, various environmental factors, diet and so forth, that may be major contributing elements that, along with genetics, may be responsible.
Mm-hmm. The for a second to go back to family history, and then I promise I have a caller here. I will not make them wait forever. I want to come back to the family history because I have read a little bit about this, and it suggests that the link might not be as strong as we think. And that often what happens is if one man in a family is diagnosed and has cancer, then what happens? Well, if it's your brother, then if you've never had your PSA tested, you go out and do it. Or if it's your dad, your chances are your awareness is going to be raised and you're going to go out and get your PSA tested. Well, and if we do that, if we start testing on these men, we're going to pick up a lot more cancers. That apparently has led some people to question the connection between close family member having it and you having increased risk.
Well, you know, one thing about prostate cancer that is true is it's such a prevalent disease that there's a lot of sporadic types of it out there. But at the same time, we do know that there are very strong family histories where there have been a series of brothers or a couple of generations in a row with prostate cancer that may seem particularly aggressive forms of this. So the jury remains out to fully characterize this, and there may actually be various genetic associations that we still have to make scientific discoveries about.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I think that the data would suggest that if you do have a family history here, please take heed.
Yeah. Our guest, Dr. Arthur Burnett, he's a professor in the Department of Urology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He also is director of the Male Consultation Clinic and also is a scientist at the James Buchanan Brady Urological Institute at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He is one of the country's leading experts on prostate cancer. And if you have questions, please do give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. We have someone here ready to go in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm calling. I'm a man, and I'm going to be 57 in December. And I'm also a retired physician, retired intensivist. And I've opted not to get myself tested with a PSA. And, you know, I'd like to tell a story here. You know, give a little perspective and history on this topic from this story. It was a, 75-year-old Quaker gentleman. Beautiful person who came in for a routine physical. And this fancy new test had come out, the PSA, you know, this was many years ago. It really didn't tell us who was at risk or anything, you know, all these studies had come out about the early detection. So the guy went through the usual consultations and, you know, the radiation oncology guys touting their treatment and the surgeons touting their treatment. And, you know, unfortunately, this is, you know, here in the Midwest, these guys that were going to do the surgery, they didn't have the new micro vascular sparing, nerve sparing technique. You know, they didn't have that. But this Quaker gentleman opted for surgery. And, you know, I had to take care of this guy in the ICU post-op as he bled to death unnecessarily for an asymptomatic cancer, you know, detected with a new chest and operated on by surgeons who don't have the same results as they do in Johns Hopkins. So I'd like you to comment a little bit on the iatrogenesis of the treatment of this and the history and, you know, all the complications with incontinence and inability to ejaculate or get an erection and all the problems that these fancy medical techniques cause for very little benefit. Thank you.
All right. Well, the caller has given us enough to talk probably for the rest of the hour about, and he has raised all of the questions I had planned to raise and questions that have been raised, starting with this question of the PSA test and who should have it, and should all men over a certain age have it, and do we end up over-treating as a result?
Well, again, I want to thank the caller in as well, and a very provocative presentation with the case study there. To answer this question most directly, PSA testing is the test that involves taking a blood sample from a man, sending it to the laboratory where they screen for this chemical that's made only in the prostate called prostate-specific antigen, abbreviated PSA, that refers to any kind of disease state of the prostate. It's not specific for prostate cancer, but if it's elevated outside of a range that we consider normal, it raises a flag that something is wrong with the prostate, and it can range from prostate cancer to prostatitis, which is inflammation of the prostate, to even prostate enlargement, so-called BPH. So it's not specific for prostate cancer, but it is a simple blood test. It is to be known that it's not a perfect test, and it doesn't specifically refer to prostate cancer. Other evaluations, including a digital rectal examination to examine the prostate, also could be considered for screening. Now, what's important to be said here is that these are tests that help us provide clues to consider doing the next step if something's abnormal, called a prostate biopsy. Now, should all of this be undertaken with every man? No. I think that what's important is that men should know about the risk of prostate cancer, particularly if they are in a high-risk group, and at least have an opportunity to have a discussion about the potential that they could be at risk to have prostate cancer, and have an opportunity to hear all sides of a discussion regarding the diagnosis, the treatment, potential complications of treatment, the potential benefit of getting treated. There's no doubt that many men will die of prostate cancer and have opportunities to be cured, but also hear all sides of this. And that's a discussion that should occur in all men after age 50. If you're in a high-risk group, it's thought that age 40 ought to be an opportunity whereby a physician conscientiously responsible for that patient should at least present it to the patient for discussion. And then the patient then plays a role to partake in where you go next with that evaluation.
Now, just again, to be clear, that say you have a man who is not in a high-risk group, I think that though the recommendation has at least been in the past that at age 50 that you should do do the first screen of the PSA to get a baseline, and that at that point, from that point forward, periodically, it should be checked to see what's going on with it, and particularly to see if there are any trends of it going up over time. Should every man at a certain age have his PSA checked, even if he's not in a high-risk group?
Right. So again, to clarify, age 50, as I mentioned, is an age where a discussion should at least occur so that the man can help decide whether he wants to undergo the test in the first place, and then thereafter what else he wants to do in terms of what is recommended, age 50, and then annual follow-up, so with checks. If things look good that year, that doesn't mean it's dismissed forever, but then annual checks of a PSA and a digital rectal examination yearly thereafter. But the point I'm making is that I'm not saying that every man has to have it. No, I think a discussion should be made whereby the man has the opportunity to understand the risk of prostate cancer and be a participant in his decision-making about whether he wants to undergo this evaluation or not, understanding fully the risks and benefits. And if he believes that he would follow recommendations because of the potential risk that all men have for prostate cancer, proceed ahead. At age 40, applies for the high-risk groups.
Mm-hmm. There is one, and sort of an old saw that you hear a lot, and that is something along the lines of, if you live long enough, if you're a man and you live long enough, chances are you're going to develop prostate cancer. Now, that's probably going a little far, but, you know, I wonder if, let us say, in any given year, if we could look at all of the men over 60 who died that year and look at their prostates and check to see if how many of them had cancer, do you have any idea what we would find?
Well, you are absolutely correct that prostate cancer is highly prevalent. The statistics you gave right at the beginning of the show are accurate. The point, or at least I think the message that goes along with that, is as men live longer, as men have other health illnesses that would confront a generation ago, much more commonly, better addressed, such that they now are living longer, I think we have to recognize that, yes, you can get to be 60, 70, maybe even 80 and older, and possibly still die of prostate cancer that could really constitute a threat for that man's longevity. And so I think we have to be attentive now about these real risks.
Well, that, I suppose, gets to another thing that you hear a lot, and that is because prostate cancer is a slow-growing cancer, you hear this thing that says, well, there are men who you might find cancer in their prostate, but that because it is a slow-growing cancer, it is more likely they will die of something else before they die of prostate cancer. And I suppose some people's concern there is that, well, that might lead you not to treat when perhaps you should.
Well, there, and you just spoke to one of the great dilemmas that we do face as urologic surgeons and other specialists in this field, which is to try and understand on a case-by-case basis for each man really what is his potential presentation in terms of the risk of the disease if diagnosed, or even to proceed ahead with the evaluation to become diagnosed. And even upon diagnosis now, what other factors are involved in that man's health circumstances that may affect his longevity? And there's no doubt that there are many men who will die of prostate cancer. We hear this all the time. Every day there's a man of a celebrity or in the news, we hear about prostate cancer. So men do die of prostate cancer. But what we have to figure out here is what are those men who we think we can figure out really will have the greatest likelihood of possibly dying of the prostate cancer versus dying of something else who may have a low enough threat prostate cancer that may not really be an issue for that man. And we have to really figure that out. We do have various tools that help us. At the same time, we are challenged in some respects because prostate cancer, much as for any cancer, doesn't always obey rules. So that man has to help us decide what's going on. There are other medical doctors involved in his care may also help us figure out what's going on to try and make the best decision case by case.
I have two other questions. Callers here, I get right to them, but maybe just, and we can talk some more about treatment. But again, the caller brings up the subject, and I know this, I'm sure this is in the mind of every man who is thinking about prostate cancer or is thinking about the treatment options, and that is, what are the possibility that afterwards that I'm going to have problems with sexual functioning and that I'm going to have problems with urinary continence?
Well, these risks exist for any intervention for prostate cancer in terms of localized treatments. Even for therapy that's not terribly localized, there could be effects, particularly on sexual functioning. And I'm referring there to some of the hormone treatments we use for advanced prostate cancer. But for localized disease, conventional therapies are surgery and radiation. There are some other things that are being looked at increasingly, but those are the conventional options. And the truth is, since the prostate is in such a precarious part of the body, adjacent to the areas that have to do with urinary control, sexual function, and even bowel function and control, there is some potential for risk of changes to surrounding structures that regulate these other functions of the body. So these risks do exist. I think that we should applaud the advances made in surgery and radiation to reduce these risks from decades past. And I do agree, as the caller in made the remark, that there should be dedicated specialists who really have mastered what they're doing and do this very well. And that's not just unique to Johns Hopkins, but other centers, too, are really dedicated to their patients. But I do think that every physician involved in the care of patients should do their very best for that patient to address the cancer, but minimize complications as best possible.
All right. Let's go to another caller, Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Yes, I would like you to discuss the role of PEN in diagnosis. Briefly, I had two biopsies. The second one was somewhat ambiguous. I guess different people interpreted it differently, whether it was cancer or PEN. I had a prostatectomy, left with some of the side effects from surgery to a moderate degree or modest degree. Another man in my man-to-man group, you may be familiar with that, had two biopsies that showed PEN. He didn't have surgery until a more definitive biopsy showed up a couple years later, and but he had surgery, and the cancer was beyond the prostate at that point. He's had successful treatment, but a little more intensive treatment. My biopsy at surgery really didn't describe a tumor, so neither one of us is entirely happy. I think he's more unhappy than I am. I think my doctor did the best he could for me, and maybe these situations are not always clear-cut. But what about PEN, and should doctors be operating based on PEN or not operating based on PEN? Thank you.
I'm glad to address that. PEN, P-I-N, refers to prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia. Now, I don't expect anybody out there to remember all of that, but those are fancy terms from the pathologist that refers to findings on a prostate biopsy that look suspicious and atypical but are not truly definitive for prostate cancer. And so, therefore, when a PEN diagnosis is made based on the prostate biopsy specimen, that generally will not prompt anybody to move forward with any definitive treatment on that basis alone, because it is not truly a cancer diagnosis. It is suspicious that cancer may be in the prostate, and a repeat biopsy may need to be done to actually confirm that diagnosis before taking action. So PEN does not in itself mean treatment yet, because that's not truly cancer. But PEN may be an indicator that cancer is starting to develop in the prostate, and the action should follow there to repeat a biopsy in that man. And if it's not found, maybe another biopsy would have to be done with some follow-ups, but only upon a diagnosis of prostate cancer specifically should any action, such as surgery or radiation, be undertaken.
And I don't know if the call is still there. Do you want to follow up at all?
Yes. Is it sometimes kind of a judgment call what it is? Again, there seemed to be some debate. My doctor told me I had cancer. I was in a research study, and the researchers suggested maybe I didn't have cancer, and I just wondered how tough a call is that?
Well, the PIN diagnosis is a tough call. You're absolutely right. Because there are some atypical changes of those prostate cells seen under the microscope in the tissue that the pathologist is looking at. And while there are some very strict criteria, very strict ways that they make that definition, sometimes things can be a little fuzzy at times. And if there's anything that's not definitive, a repeat biopsy may need to be done to be certain that we are dealing with a cancer diagnosis to carry out treatments that can carry risks, absolutely. But PIN is separate than cancer, and pathologists sometimes may disagree, but I think in general there seems to be a likely agreement based on criteria. But then again, even here at Johns Hopkins, if a patient comes to see me, I'll ask that patient to have his pathology slide sent to our pathologist, because a pathologist here who may be, let's say, very much focused on prostate cancer just because of the volume of the samples they're seeing and their focus on this disease, perhaps more than other places, may be able to be more definitive about what they're seeing.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We are here at our midpoint. Our guest, let me introduce our guest for anyone who has just tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Arthur Burnett. He's one of the country's leading authorities on prostate cancer. He's a professor in the Department of Urology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He also is director of the Basic Science Lab in Neurourology there. In addition, he has posts at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. He directs their male consultation clinic, and he's also clinician scientist at the James Buchanan Brady Urological Institute, and he is the co-author of a recent book that could provide some good information to people who are thinking about prostate cancer. Maybe you've had the diagnosis. Maybe someone near and dear to you has been diagnosed. The title of the book is Prostate Cancer Survivors Speak Their Minds, where a number of men talk about their experiences, and then the doctor adds on some notes about their specific cases and more generally about thinking about prostate cancer and what kind of treatments work best for each guy. The book is published by Wiley. It's out now. Questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we have someone on a cell phone on our line four. We'll go there. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'd just like to ask the doctor to comment on the situation, mine. Gradually but significantly increased PSA over the last 7 or 8 years, and nothing ever on the DREs, and 4 negative biopsies. I mean, besides the fact that they're obviously negative, is there any other meaning you would attach to that?
Well, glad to respond to that, and what I'm hearing then is that you've had changes in your PSA with a normal feeling prostate on the exam, and you've had 4 biopsies now, all negative. So what that means is that perhaps there are changes in your prostate as you get older. The prostate may enlarge and just produce more of this chemical release from the prostate, again, the PSA. Yes, if it keeps rising, I think we have to be on the alert that we want to make sure that we look after you and make sure we're not missing a prostate cancer diagnosis and do it in a timely way. But this is a scenario that we see quite often, frankly. Once a biopsy is done, which is absolutely necessary to make a diagnosis, that if it's negative, we just have to reassure that man that we don't really identify prostate cancer as being the issue here, and he just has to be reassured.
Hmm. So that you're not going to get too many false negatives here. That is, someone who actually might have cancer, but as a result of your biopsy, you will say to that man, well, yes, you have this elevated PSA, and we're going to continue to watch that, but right now what we're saying to you is we don't see any cancer.
That is correct. Now, know that if we see continue to rise, repeat biopsies may be necessary. So more than just one, if a follow-up 6 months or a year visit suggests it's rising further, appropriately another biopsy should be done. And in fact, sometimes we'll recommend that more samples be taken or other strategies in doing the biopsy should be done to make sure we're very thorough about trying to sample the prostate enough to be certain about ruling out that prostate cancer diagnosis. But really, it does occur that some men, after getting biopsied, will have to just give them reassurance, at least at that moment, but continue to be followed. Because if it keeps going, we may still have to repeat it even afterwards.
And as you explained, just to make sure people understand that the PSA test, prostate-specific antigen test, is a blood test, and what you get back is a number. And so at what number, what PSA number, do you start to get concerned?
Well, you know, traditionally we think of anything above a value of 4 would be concerning. Now, we're starting to revise our thinking, and there have been various thought leader panels that have gotten together without being too detailed and specifics here, but have provided some guidelines that we're starting to think that anything above a value of 2.5 might be concerning. But the additional remark here, and this gentleman here with his nice remark, was a nice story, prompts me to say that one thing that helps us also is how the PSA changes over time. We use this term PSA velocity. Or rate of change to refer to how the PSA may change. So that a man, for example, who's had a PSA, let's say for years it's been 0.8 or 0.9, let's say, and then suddenly now it's 2.8 and repeated it's 3.0, that even though while it seems to be less than the 4 range, that change still may concern us from a year prior or something like that, and that may prompt the next step, which is the prostate biopsy, on the basis of the PSA velocity change.
Mm. As you've explained, one thing that can lead to an elevated PSA is a prostate infection. So you could have prostatitis, and you could have an elevated PSA, and that's not cancer. So, and again, I think as some people want to stress, The test is, it's prostate-specific, not cancer-specific, so it just means something's going on with the prostate. Are there a lot of other things other than cancer, number one, and infection, number two, that could result in an elevated PSA?
Well, again, just as all men get older, prostates tend to get larger, not exclusively, and just by the sheer volume of tissue, the amount of tissue there, that has a correlation with the amount of PSA that's released from this prostate tissue, and that also then is a major factor. So I think those are your big considerations there.
Mm. And we talked earlier about the fact that, one of the problems with prostate cancer is that there aren't a lot of symptoms. I guess one thing that you could say is that you could have a benign enlarged prostate, which is pretty normal, and you could have some urinary symptoms. Well, you could also have a prostate that was enlarged as a result of cancer and have the same kind of symptoms. So it might be that if you have those sorts of symptoms, you might not want to just brush them off.
Well, that's true. But conclusion here is that symptoms do not correlate with prostate cancer, but symptoms should be addressed if they are affecting a man's life. But more often than not, symptoms refer to changes in the lower urinary tract area with or without prostate enlargement, and they may need to be addressed just for the sake of helping a man be symptomatically well. But don't wait for symptoms to say, hey, something's really wrong with my prostate, and particularly prostate cancer. That is fallacious in terms of, or fallacy to think that.
All right, let's talk with some other folks. Line one, this is Champagne. Hello. Caller there on line one.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to take a different direction on the conversation, if that's okay.
Sure.
You know, it's not just the patient and the doctor. You know, we're in a society, we're in a country that's floundering economically. You know, we're drowning economically. Extreme healthcare costs are a big part of the problem. And how do we rein these in when, you know, people want endless biopsies and they want, you know, endless screenings for very little benefit? You know, you know, with this prostate stuff, you're screening a whole bunch of people that, and you're treating you're only successfully treating a few that really needed it, and you're treating another few that didn't even need it, and you're treating them anyway, and you're having to, you know, pay for all these complications and all these, you know. Meanwhile, we have a country with childhood immunization rates for measles less than Mexico. So how does the economic and policy making fit in with all of this? Thank you.
All right. Well, again, kind of getting back to this question of who do you screen and how much screening do you do, and then what's the follow on to the screening?
Yeah. Well, you know, no doubt this is a hot button topic, and I echo the comments of the caller in that we need to be very careful in how we go about recommendations. We certainly have to be cognizant of health economics and health policy surrounding various diseases, including prostate cancer. No doubt, I agree that a lot of men are probably overtreated for prostate cancer, and where that comes from is, it can be various sources. So I wholeheartedly agree with that. The conversation here could go on much longer with various other health economists and so forth. But I certainly do echo the comment that we need to be more attentive to this. At the same time, we do recognize men can die of prostate cancer. And that's why you hear me make the emphasis here that I'm not saying every man has to go out and get treated or get treated in a certain way. What I'm saying is I think that there needs to be discussion surrounding this topic. I think high-risk groups in particular need to be aware, and men should be aware of how we at least discuss it and have the opportunity to go about an evaluation if they so desire.
Is doing a PSA test particularly expensive?
Well, the blood test in itself is depending upon the laboratory facility, $50, $75, something in that range. So the test in itself is not too expensive, but I think the question next is where do we go with that information? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this test? Was it discussed with the patient to understand what it means? If it is abnormal, what action would follow from that? What cost to bear taking any action? If all of this is going to be moot for some patients, then at least that discussion is done, documented for physician's sake and patient's sake, and then you just move on.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Monticello, and it's line three. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions. My first question is, if you had prostate cancer, had a prostatectomy, and the cancer had spread to seminal vesicles, which were removed, where does cancer tend to go to second, prostate cancer? And my second question is, if it sometimes goes to the bones, is there a bone augmentation therapy that has been tried and been successful, like Zometa or something, to build a bone and some kind of proactive way to prevent cancer spreading? That's my two questions.
Well, certainly I can answer that. I certainly want to back up a little bit, because I think you're describing things that may be ahead of many other listeners out there. So first, the issue about prostate cancer spread. Prostate cancer can spread locally to adjacent structures, including the seminal vesicles. It can spread to lymph node tissue that's adjacent to the prostate and get into the lymph node system of the body. It can spread to bone. And in time, it could pretty much spread to almost any structure in the body altogether. So that's generally how prostate cancer tends to spread, local and distant spread through lymphatic tissue as well as blood circulation. So that's how prostate cancer spreads. I hope that just addresses the question most directly. As far as the next question having to do with bone spread, what kind of intervention?
No, well, my question about if it's removed from local tissue, then you have to be careful and watch for prostate cancer to come back. What's the region that it comes back in second?
Well, as mentioned, even upon removal, the prostate cancer from the prostate, cancerous mm-hmm. cells, could have mm-hmm. spread through lymphatics, which are little tributaries of how things spread in the body, the lymph node system, or mm-hmm. through the blood circulation. And even in a man who's had his prostate and seminal vesicles removed, it's possible that prostate cancer cells could have already been spread along these channels even prior to the prostatectomy, and it was microscopic and unbeknownst to the best, most conscientious physician working everything up and saying, we think we're still timely here. It's possible that cancer cells could have already been spreading along these channels and elsewhere in the body. So the areas that I've spoken about are potential locations where it could have already been progressing microscopically in situations where a man has had a prostatectomy, and it becomes manifest later in the lymph node system of the body, possibly in bone, and in time could be any structure of the body.
Okay.
Now, the second question, which is how do we address bone metastases? Fancy words of saying cancer spread in a distant way from a primary origin for where the cancer developed, and prostate cancer does have a tendency to go to bone. What do we do about bone structure? Now, this is important because prostate cancer spread to bone can cause bone pain, can cause bone fractures, can have all kinds of additional complications in men. It can eat away at the bone and cause changes. Now, there are therapies that are out there, typically offered by specialists who do advanced prostate cancer management. We think of medical oncologists playing this role primarily, where there are various medications that are offered that are bone strengthening medications. And so you mentioned Zometa, and there's other therapies out there that are used once the patient's evaluated. Various kinds of skeletal scans are done. And this may be combined with various therapies, particularly if a man's receiving even hormone-blocking medications that mm-hmm. try to shut
yeah.
down how this cancer may progress. So in men, since prostate cancer is related to hormones, androgens or testosterone, for advanced disease, we may have to think about ways to try and reduce those hormones in the body. We use the term androgen deprivation to generally talk about this, to try and slow the cancer rate of spread and how it advances in parts of the body. But this sort of androgen deprivation in slowing the cancer down can have consequences elsewhere in the body, including causing so-called osteoporosis in men's bones, if that's something the listening audience can kind of have an understanding of. So there's various therapies that are combined with the therapy specifically for the cancer, but also to address some of the bone complications. So I hope that gives the audience an understanding and helps your understanding about what's going on.
But do you ever do a therapy that's proactive, a therapy as intense as Zometa, for example?
Metastasized. Yeah, so before it metastasized, do we do something preemptively, you're asking?
Uh-huh.
Something that we
yeah.
may aggressively do. And I have to tell you, that generally is not done. Generally, it's in the course of a man's evaluation, if he actually is going to be started on androgen-blocking medication, androgen deprivation therapies, then that may be combined with that. But it's just not something that's just generally done just in a preventative way unless there's some indication to do that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Arthur Burnett. He is a professor in the Department of Urology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's also director of the Male Consultation Clinic at Johns Hopkins Hospital and is the co-author of a book that's titled Prostate Cancer Survivors Speak Their Minds and is published by Wiley. And we're talking about prostate cancer, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll continue here. We have another caller, someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'd like you to comment on the usefulness of the digital rectal exam. I just had a checkup. I'm in my 50s last week, and the doctor said, well, studies indicated that the DRE doesn't really do anything, so he didn't want to do it, and we didn't do it. And I mentioned this to my son-in-law, who's in med school, and he sent me back some stuff from Standard Reference 2007 saying that the PSC and the DRE together are better than just the PSA alone. And then he followed up with another study saying that in terms of outcome, it didn't make any difference. The DRE wasn't useful. So could you comment on that?
Well, you certainly raise a question that is out there among the controversies. The big one being, if we've got this blood test that's been available now the past 20 to 25 years, how relevant is the DRE? And, in fact, for many men, not to have to do a DRE, which is not pleasant generally for most patients or even for the physician to want to do this, what role does it offer if you have this alternative test? And the answer is that it still is very important because there are many cases where the PSA is not as informative as you'd like to have guided a biopsy, and the DRE would have been the evaluation that would have said, gosh, something is wrong here. And it is very much true that as much as 15% of clinically significant prostate cancers that could be a threat to a man's life do occur where the PSA is in a normal range. So if you rely on that PSA, you will potentially have a missed diagnosis. And given the fact that the digital rectal examination, again, though challenging for some and embarrassing and what have you and all these other kinds of taboo words, still it's just a matter of a gloved finger that's well lubricated, a very simple thing to do, and it's probably one of the most cost-effective tools we could ever do, just a part of the exam for a man, just to evaluate for an abnormality on the prostate exam that might prompt a biopsy when the PSA in some men may still be in a normal range.
Okay, and then what do you actually feel for? Is it the size or the texture? I mean, this may be complicated, but I'm just curious what the DRE tells you.
Well, the DRE does provide all of that information, but for prostate cancer, we become very suspicious. We feel some hardness, a nodule that's discrete, and almost like feeling a knuckle on your hand there. But anything that feels hard and not the typical texture of the prostate, which should have the feel of a eraser on the pencil there, rubber eraser, give us some concern.
But this is like a donut, right? So you're not feeling all sides of the donut, are you?
Well, the prostate does have different sides to it. So you're right. We can't feel the side that's up inside you, which is just beneath the pubic bone area. We're just feeling the surface that's abutting the rectal wall. So it's not perfect, too, because you can't feel the whole prostate. But most prostate cancers, just biologically speaking, tend to develop on the surface abutting the prostate, abutting the rectum. And we call this the peripheral zone. And so a good exam for prostate cancer evaluation may be able to still detect it for where most cancers tend to develop, not exclusively, but at least predominantly.
What about some scanning technique that would allow you to visualize the prostate?
Well, various imaging studies have been well considered. That's a great thought, and believe me, there are many who've thought about various kinds of imaging techniques, from what we think of like CAT scans or MRI mm-hmm. studies, and maybe even other advanced imaging techniques that are in development. At this point in time, they're useful to help show the size of the prostate, the various maybe dimensions of the prostate, its shape, and so forth. To date, though, none is completely fault-free to make a cancer diagnosis just based on what things look like. And so the biopsy still has to be done.
All right. I want to thank the caller and go to someone else here. Danville is next, line four. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
There's been some discussion about the fact that you have to decide who should be treated, and that's a difficult decision. Is there any research being done to see if there is a more virulent strain of prostate cancer that could be detected, or some genetic difference between a slower-growing prostate cancer and something that would be more aggressive?
Well, very good thoughts. I mean, the idea here, frankly, is that not all prostate cancers are the same. It's well recognized that is so. We do think that as we've evolved scientifically, we have the opportunity with the biopsy material that helps us be guided by the findings of the biopsy tissue that tells us who's more has a more aggressive cancer and guide us in terms of other kinds of blood tests, biomarkers, other tools that might help us make these kind of decisions, genetic markers and so forth. This sort of investigative work is ongoing, and believe me, that there are many people involved in looking at these sorts of things, but nothing quite yet is a tool that we use regularly.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And to Urbana for another caller here, line two. Hello.
Yes. I am glad to hear Dr. Burnett emphasize that people do die from prostate cancer. My husband was diagnosed last year, and with a Gleason score of 7, my understanding is that is moderately aggressive, which sounds like he could die from it. Whereas I think we took it not seriously enough in some ways, because the popular media conveys so much the idea that you won't die from prostate cancer, it's not that serious, et cetera, et cetera. So I just basically sort of making that comment that I appreciate that sort of emphasis that they're not all the same and that some are more lethal than others. Hopefully he will be okay. He's had the prostatectomy and radiation and hormone therapy, but we're still waiting to see.
Well, thank you for sharing, and certainly I would just sound back to you, get that I'm glad you're making that point, because I think that the audience needs to know we need to try to rate what we find with prostate cancer, or find out who really has aggressive forms. You're referring to the Gleason score, which refers to the pathologist looking at the prostate tissue under the microscope, either with a biopsy or a final surgical specimen taken out, and rating it along a scale of what's really the most angry-looking, the treacherous prostate cancer, which tends to be Gleason scores 8, 9, and 10, almost as a group, and that's the highest numbers you could have, 7 being moderately aggressive and 6 being more in the intermediate range. But the pathologist, again, following their criteria, can help us understand that, and we know that the cancer behavior correlates with findings that they can see under the microscope in terms of how these cells just look. And so no doubt, we do know prostate cancer can kill. And so we have to be aware of that. try to move forward, particularly in those men who we consider to be a high threat, to save their lives.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, one more caller here, Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm just calling to give some food for thought here on prevention. I'm a yoga practitioner, Iyengar yoga, for over 33 years. And my colleagues that I've known all this time, it seems that the yoga practice delays trouble with urination or any kind of prostate enlargement by an average of about 10 to 15 years. Of course, you know, this isn't a scientific study, but I always encourage my young students to do certain poses, hip openers especially, that help to keep the lymphatic system healthy and to keep the circulation in that region open to maintain the prostate health. So I was just calling with that.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Dr. Burnett, anything you want to add?
Well, yeah, my thoughts about that is that I welcome all kinds of ideas, things that we may learn about, by all means. I do think that things have to be carefully evaluated, and there may be certain levels at which we talk about scientific study. So these things have to be looked at in that kind of critical way, both for diagnosis and treatment. I hope the audience recognizes that while these things may be helpful if they've not been critically studied, please still seek out the proper a physician to sort things out.
Sure. And maybe one other thing we might add is, again, there are still a lot of questions about what causes prostate cancer, but in terms of advice, things you can do to lower your risk, diet seems to play some sort of role, at least in the respect that a high-fat diet puts you at a greater risk. So following the dietary, actually the same, I think sort of the same dietary recommendations that are thought to reduce your risk of having colon cancer, for example, seem also to be the same sorts of things that are thought to lower your risk of prostate cancer. So that's kind of a two-for-one there if you think about having a healthier diet. Probably also good for your heart, too.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. While some of this is still not completely definitive, and many times, you know, a lot of scientific work has to go into years of investigation to be definitive about recommendations. But I think early evidence would suggest that the very best cardiovascular healthy diet probably applies to reducing risk for various cancers, including prostate cancer.
And just real quick, what do you think about Proscar, finasteride?
Well, just quickly, Proscar has been championed as a medication that may reduce a man's risk for prostate cancer. It's a medication that blocks an enzyme in the prostate that converts a certain form of testosterone to another form that has to do with prostate development and maybe have a role in prostate cancer the development and progression. There's a lot of controversy out there about all of this, and I'm not sure I can answer it all in 30 seconds, but I think that the discussion may have to be had with a urologist for each man, because that medication typically has a role to help shrink the prostate to help with urination. Its role in preventing prostate cancer progression is still very much debated. While there has been some evidence that there may be some benefit, there's still some issues associated with that.
All right.
And I think a discussion has to be had with a urologist.
Our guest, Dr. Arthur Burnett at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and also Johns Hopkins Hospital. He's the co-author of Prostate Cancer Survivors Speak Their Minds. And Dr. Burnett, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure to be with you.